Hi everyone, and welcome to Keyframe, the Geek Show's dedicated animation podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today are Mark.
Hello.
Tucky.
Hello.
And Andrew.
Welcome to hell.
So, how is everybody after that taxing trailer thing?
Yeah, slightly confused now.
I'm always confused.
Yeah.
It's really, really warm today as well, like... I've got one of these special jelly wrist things for my computer, and it's like sticking to me wrist.
Is it a boob mouse, Matt?
No, hold on, I'm going to change it.
Now you're going to get the boob mouse, Matt.
Is the boob mouse, Matt, more cooling than the gel mouse,
Matt? No, it's a boob mouse, Matt. It's yeah. A lot more better for the carpal tunnel syndrome.
Is it actually... Does it have like a cooling function so it cools your wrist down at the same time?
It's just made out of a different material.
Is it a silk or a peach finish?
It's a lot more padded as well.
Jesus,
it's a lot more padded, is it? Oh, anyway.
I always find it weird because you basically put the mouse on the face. So they can't judge you while you're using your computer.
Anyway. Enough of the booby mouse mats and stuff like that. Considering there's been not much else happening in the world, shall we crack on?
Yeah. Shall I go first?
Yeah.
Well, I've actually been watching Lupin the Third, Part 4, and Part 5, which has been ongoing. And this was something I kind of wanted to cover a little bit last week when we were talking about last month's anime. Because... this is another one of those series that has been around for forever.
How old is Lupin?
The manga started in 1967.
Wow. Isn't the manga actually based on an actual person, though?
Because
his first name isn't Lupin. His surname is Lupin. It's Arsène Lupin, isn't it?
It's Arsène Lupin. Yeah. Grandson of Arsène Lupin.
I've got the Wikipedia page open. I remember where it is. He's the grandson of Arsène Lupin, who is the gentleman thief from Maurice Leblanc's series of novels.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, so this is another series, much like Ashita no Joe, that has been going around forever and ever and ever. And this is, well, it says part 4, but let's be realistic. This is like part 22 or something like that, because there's been many, many specials, there's been many, many films, there's been many... reboots and other stuff from it.
Don't forget, and there's been the crossovers as well. Lupin versus Detective Conan, for example.
That's right, yeah. And then they had ones that kind of just were based on each of the characters. They had a Jigen series, they had a Fujiko Mine series. Yep. I think they had a Goemon series as well.
Ishikawa Goemon, Spray of Blood. I think it was a miniseries, or it might have been a movie.
I think it was a movie. But yeah, it's one of those series that's been going on forever, and you can actually see a lot of the stuff that influenced other series.
Yeah.
Like, if you look at Lupin and then you look at One Piece,
oh yeah,
you can see a lot of what has went in from that.
Thing is, Oda's made no secret about that. He's already said that Lupin has been a massive influence on him.
Exactly, and it's... this stands the test of time as well. It's one of those series that when it keeps getting rebooted, it keeps getting brought back, it usually is pretty good.
They did a poll, I think it was the year before last, about the sexiest character in anime, and Fujiko Mine topped the list again.
Yeah, and you can see why, because she is the femme fatale of anime, really.
Yeah, she is. She's like, you know, in those gumshoe novels from the 1920s, of all the offices she had to walk into, this dame walked into mine, that sort of thing. She's one of those femme fatales, isn't she?
Exactly. I mean, if you've never seen Lupin, you should watch it. I mean, it's one of those things I would say it for everybody should at least try and watch it at some point, because it's so weird in the fact that you don't see anything quite like it in anime. It's one of those series where it's like, it's basically every episode is a different heist. It's a little bit of James Bond. It's a little bit of like Catch Me If You Can. It's a little bit of Ocean's 11 or whatever you want to call it. It's very much like its own thing, and you don't see much other like series and anime that try to imitate it try to even do the heists and stuff like that.
It's interesting you say that because there's one big heist movie that you haven't mentioned, but Lupin is generally as tongue-in-cheek as The Italian Job.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the Mark Wahlberg, Edward Norton version. I'm talking about the original Michael Caine version where Mr. Bridges says, I want you to find Charlie Croker and give him a jolly good going over.
Yeah, it's if you love stuff like Italian Job and stuff like that, you will really enjoy it because it still feels, even this is part four, which was released about 3 or 4 years ago now.
Yeah.
It still feels that it was meant for that time period. It's actually quite weird because in part five, they've actually made Lupin more up to date and he's kind of became a meme in the series. Whereas this is still kind of, you can't exactly place when it's supposed to take place.
Yeah.
Possibly sometime. I'm going to go with late 70s, late 80s because one of the characters is pretty much James Bond that he ends up fighting. And yeah, like I said, it's a really, really fun series. And what was interesting was, like Andrew was saying last week, is that you don't see many series that try to do the old style.
Yeah.
This is another series that does the old style.
Yeah.
Like, you could actually watch this and you would think it was an anime from 20 to 30 years ago. And yeah, like I said, this is part four. It's been released by Anime Limited. It's got 26 episodes. Now, most of the episodes are standalone. There is an overall story with it, which begins with Lupin getting married, to Fujiko. And that kind of is the basis for the story, which kind of goes through the whole thing. And it kind of gets a little bit bizarre towards the end. But all of the favourite characters are there. You've got Fujiko, you've got Goemon, you've got Jigen, you've got Inspector Zenigata, who has a really good episode with Lupin, where he finally catches Lupin, and Lupin's kind of like chose to die, and then really makes Zenigata kind of wonder. It's like, well, if Lupin dies, then Zenigata dies as well, because he's been chasing him for that long. He really doesn't know how to live without him.
It's one of those weird things which I think Lupin has done really well. They're basically kind of codependent on each other. Lupin wouldn't feel the same. If Zenigata died, Lupin wouldn't be Lupin.
Exactly. And it's like, Zenigata is one of those characters that you can tell. It's just like, he is the legit hero, because obviously Lupin's the thief. So it's like, but he's one of those ones where he's after Lupin, but he will help out quite often as well.
Yeah, it's not like Jabba the Hutt chasing after Han Solo. It's not that kind of relationship.
No, it's kind of just like a Lupin and Zenigata relationship, really. It's like the easiest way to talk about it is like Catch Me If You Can, where the cop spends the whole of his career just trying to trace this one criminal, and they end up coming to respect each other. Mm. But yeah, overall, I would really suggest checking it out. It's a good starting point if you've never seen Lupin before. And you get up to speed with the characters pretty quickly. And the visuals are nice. It's like I said, they try to go off the old style. I think it is the same guys who did Megalobox, who did this Tokyo Movie Shinsha, I think that's called. So yeah, they've actually been working on Lupin the Third Part 5 and Megalobox at the same time.
Awesome.
This season, so, but yeah, it's definitely worth checking out if you want to see something that's classic and still holds up today.
So you mean classic and classy at the same time?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's nothing more classy than a Lupin opening.
I think if you're gonna go for the full Lupin effect, you want to watch it as if you were so middle class it hurts. So smoking jacket, big fat cigar, brandy, and just sit back.
and watch the fun. It's actually one of those series that's really, really easy just to sit and watch as well.
Yeah,
like you don't have to sit and focus on it completely. You can kind of do other things while you're watching it. So it's a nice, relaxing one.
Awesome. Who's next?
Oh well, no, it wasn't Ryback who said who's next. That's feeding me, isn't it?
No, who's next? Goldberg.
I suppose I've talked myself into this one, haven't I?
Yes, you have.
So it's, I've literally just been to the cinema. I don't pirate movies. Are you listening? People. It's and I've been seeing the Incredibles. I don't know why it's French, but it is now. It's been this really overhyped thing since I think it was like the Disney Expo announced it, and everyone was like, "Ah, keep your kids at home. I'm going to see this movie. If your kids ruin it, I'll ruin you." I took my kids anyway because screw them.
Well, it's a kids movie. Have you ever watched Stuart Lee's Comedy of Equal?
No.
Right. If you get a chance, watch it. It's brilliant. Stuart Lee's a great comedian. But on the very first episode of Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle, he's talking about toilet books, and then he starts talking about Harry Potter and how adults are going up to him saying, "Have you read the latest Harry Potter?" He's like, "No, I haven't read the latest Harry Potter because I'm a 40-year-old man. It's a book for children."
He has a point.
It is.
Well, it's just one of them things. The Disney, dare I say, the Disney fandom, they've got this whole thing, like, because they're now middle-aged, like, adults. Well, early to middle-aged adults.
See, you call them fandom.
Yeah, fandom.
Now let's call them by their true name: the Disney Automatons, created by the Imagineers at Disney.
Imagine that! It's just some bloke messing about, like,
Oh look,
this one's going to be the biggest Rey fangirl ever, and this one's going to be the biggest Kylo Ren fanboy, and they're going to fight, and then they're going to get together.
No,
and then we're going to kill each other.
No, I'm going to I am going to write a short story where a Disney Imagineer stumbles on the formula for fandom, and starts creating fans left, right, and center. Who releases it? It'll be like 12 Monkeys all over again. Oh, The Walking Dead, but everyone's a Disney fan.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's The Incredibles 2. Sorry to go off topic again. It's one of those things where this movie has been hyped to the hilt up the wazoo through whatever you want. It's one of them ones. So obviously, it's Disney. You know, it's probably going to get a few Oscar nominations, maybe win a few awards, even though Disney, like, are the people giving out the awards. But, seeing The Incredibles 1, it starts off, basically the movie starts off, as you can probably see in the trailers, it starts off where movie one left off. Syndrome's been defeated, and now we're into this whole thing of the Underminer.
Who's basically the Mole Man.
Yeah. Fantastic use of puns throughout the whole movie, by the way. But I'm trying to go through this without, like, spoiling it, because, like I said, it's fresh, like, literally fresh out over here. I think it's been out in America for weeks, or
I might be able to help you on that then, right? Because they basically gave most of the story in the trailers, right?
Yeah, and the trailers of trailers.
So if you've seen the trailers, you'll know the story. Somebody wants to bring back superheroes, chooses Elastigirl as the poster.
The ace of the company.
Yeah, the ace of the company, the poster child of superheroes. And then that's all you need to know, right? You've got Mr. Incredible left literally holding the baby being Jack.
Yeah, it's one of them weird ones because, like you say, everything's in the trailer. Mr. Incredible deals with being a house husband.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Look at that. So the sexes have changed. The woman's successful now. The bloke isn't. How's he going to handle that? Well, he's not going to handle that because he's a bloke.
I've got to ask.
It's one of those things, but no, he pulls through.
I've got to ask one thing, Tucky.
Yeah.
How much of the good bits did they put in the trailer?
Basically, I could do a whole spoiler recap of the movie just from them.
Right.
Just from the clips on YouTube, you could literally masterfully paste together, and you can do, like, The Incredibles in 5 seconds. And that's the whole movie. The thing is, like, I was looking forward to it because, you know, the Bens like The Incredibles, but they weren't really, like, hyped for it or anything. I mean, I liked The Incredibles. I think it was an R-rated movie, the first one. But the second one, you know, obviously it's a cash grab because everything about Disney is like cash grab. And I have a feeling that this movie's been released like about 10 years too late. I think they've been waiting like 12, 13 years for it. This would have been fantastic. 2 to 3 years after the first movie, great. But well, I feel like they've sat on it.
Not even 2 to 3 years.
It hasn't matured.
Yeah, not even 2 to 3 years after the first movie. Do you know when it would have been a prime time for them to release this movie?
On the back of the Avengers?
Yep.
Yeah.
It's like It's like they've really missed a trick by waiting to like phase four of the whole Marvel cinematic universe thing.
Well, they had two prime times to release this on the back of the Avengers and right with Fan4Stick. Because if they'd released this alongside Fan4Stick, people would have gone, Fan4Stick doesn't even get what the Fantastic Four is supposed to be about. Let's go watch The Incredibles, which is actually a much better Fantastic Four movie than the Fantastic Four.
Yeah. And like you say, I can't really go into too much detail without spoiling much, but I'll go through what is in the trailers. Like you say, The Incredibles, supers are still illegal, still considered illegal. And Blokey comes up to them and says, basically, look, it's not really supers that are the problem. It's the image that's portrayed of you. Because all people see is images of destruction on the TV and you guys. They don't actually see. So they come up with this idea of let's put cameras in the super suits. And obviously, things go awry and they've got this whole, oh, we'll try and get supers made legal. But there's like a little subplot because the evil person who you think's going to be evil is, it's that obvious. Like as soon as they appear on the screen, on the telly, on the cinema or whatever you're watching it on, you look and you're going, well, they're obviously the bad guy. So, and it turns out they're obviously the bad guy.
So they put cameras in the suits, which,
yeah,
considering the suits are, some of the suits are for men and women. Where are the cameras is my first concern. My second concern is...
On Elastigirl's new suit, it's just above her right nipple.
There's the hentai for you.
Yep, and my second concern is, isn't that just Tiger and Bunny?
No. Tiger and don't say Tiger and Bunny, man. No, Tiger and Bunny's. It's not so much heavy on the sponsorship, but it is. It's a PR stunt thing. It's basically like let's get supers. Let's give this whole PR image of, well, you're fighting bad guys. Here, we'll edit a figure. We'll get all the footage of you fighting them. We'll edit it and make you guys look good. And then the people in like the Congress or what have you, they'll be sitting there looking and say, well, obviously they're edited to do good. You know, well, what can we do? We'll have to make supers legal again. And then you find out, like, oh, there's like this little band of supers that were supers, but there were supers in hiding. One's Portal Girl, who uses, it's portals, isn't it? It's like the game Portal. Yeah. One's a guy who can crush with his mind. Regurgitation Man or something, or Reflux Man. It's a weird power to have. Owl Blokey, big guy from Wisconsin.
Reflux Man?
Yeah, Reflux Man. He regurgitates hot molten lava.
Yeah. Wasn't he in Deadpool?
No, can't see Deadpool.
No, wasn't he in Deadpool 2? He fell into the garbage bin. Sorry, this is a spoiler for anyone.
Oh, no, it's the acid. That's the acid one.
He's got acid reflux.
Yeah. Well, Incredibles are there. The thing is, like, throughout this whole movie, I mean, the movie at the beginning has got this little special, you know how they do, like, the animation special, like, a little clip. It's called Bao, or B-A-O. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right.
That's the one about the bun, isn't it?
Eh?
That's the one about the bun, isn't it?
Yeah, the bun which comes to life, and then it turns out it's actually quite a, like, simple metaphor for an estranged son relationship.
It's
yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, and it's kind of beautiful, though, isn't it?
Oh, but that's the thing. That's what they want you to be. It's not as good as, like, the Brazilian bloke with a heart who all he wants to do is go surfing, but instead he's working his life away.
Yeah, I know. It's not as good as that, but it was still quite sweet.
It is, but that's how they start you off, though. It's, like, sweet, and then it's like, oh, main presentation. For me, the Incredibles 2, if you've watched the first one, probably for closure, I'd say watch the second one. But it's not really go out, slap your money in the face of the person working at the cinema. Don't slap money in the face of the person working at the cinema. They've got a hard enough life as it is anyway. But it's not worth the hype. I think Disney's left it way too late because the plot's obvious. The characters are the same. The only one who gets plot development and character development is Jack-Jack. And all that's ruined in the trailers. Because you know he shoots lasers from his eyes. You know he turns into a demon. You know he can explode into fire. You know he can transfer into dimensions and only returns when offered cookies. It's like, you know, everything's in the trailer. So,
question. Yeah, now, I might delete this because this might sound quite wrong, but is the mom a strong female role model superhero?
Yeah, that's what they're going for. They're going for the whole brand of
That's why they've released it, isn't it? Because there's been a lot of backlash on people like Black Widow and Scarlet Witch, and just being a side character and not very strong female role model.
Well, that's one of the reasons why in Infinity War, Scarlet Witch, while she's not there, the battle's going badly. As soon as she turns up, all of a sudden, the battle turns around and, you know, everybody's ass is getting kicked.
Yeah, because there was a bit of backlash on that. They weren't focusing enough on the female superheroes and not making them marketable.
They definitely focus on the female superheroes here. Violet gets a lot more, but she has like her own little side story, so to speak. Because the guy who she asks out on a date at the end of the first one, he has to have his mind erased because, you know, he's seen her without a mask on. And then all of a sudden she's like, oh, you remember me, Dit? Do you remember me? And he's like, no, sorry. And then it's like, oh, no, I hate you all. I renounce being a superhero. Sticks the super suit in the like trash compactor blender thing that they have in sinks in America. Her powers, well, you're not disappearing. She does visible barriers. There's nothing else to go on, really. Dash is just small and runs around. Dash actually has very little in this movie.
Well, like I said, the Incredibles are basically the Fantastic Four with roles reversed. Violet is basically Susan Storm. Mr. Incredible is the Thing. Elastigirl is Mr. Fantastic. You know, yeah. Dash is basically Johnny Storm. Because remember, what was Johnny Storm before he got his fire powers? He was a race driver.
He was also an arrogant douche.
Which is basically...
just like Dash.
Yeah, exactly. That's Dash, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's like I say, there's lots of parallels if you're a Fantastic Four fan as well. And but as an animated feature, it's typical overhyped Disney, which came way too late. So I'd suggest, yes, watch it, but don't pay full price when it's like dropped or
wait until it's on Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix. All the Christmas movies this year. Oh, Christmas!
So Andrew, what are you doing?
Right. What I'm going to talk about is, so over the last couple of days and that is a couple of significant details for the upcoming Dragon Ball Super movie in December has been released. Okay. Now, it's been speculation for a good few months and that. Who's the villain in the trailer from a couple of months ago? Is it a new character? Is it Yamoshi, who was a hinted character of like the original Super Saiyan, the original Super Saiyan God that was hinted at in the series for years. And what is it? It's Broly. Broly was a character from the original Dragon Ball Z movies in the 90s. He was like the original legendary Super Saiyan that just has one of the most ridiculous and stupid backstories ever. It's like this is one of the most overpowered characters ever. And he has a grudge against the main character of the series because he made him cry as a baby because Goku.
In all fairness, I want to smack the shit out the kid who was crying next to me when I was in maternity ward.
That's a moment.
All I can say to this is that Tucky didn't realise that was actually a mirror. He was the kid crying in the maternity ward.
Surprised to remember.
One of these days, still a better backstory than the actual side story, backstory, whatever. Of the original Broly character.
All I'm going to say is, that proves what I've been saying for ages. He's out of ideas. Let him go. Let him do something else.
I'm not going to lie. I saw the poster for it and I got really excited because I actually thought it was Yamcha in the background. Yamcha's done with this shit. He's just going to go like rogue and just kill them all.
See, if that was Dragon Ball, if that was the Dragon Ball movie, right? That Yamcha had basically had it with being pushed around by everybody who was stronger than him, and he'd basically gone syndrome, you know.
Well, actually, there is a manga spin-off in that of some guy gets reincarnated in Yamcha and that before the launch of the Dragon Ball series, and he has to make Yamcha good.
Yeah, I was just about to say, they're releasing that in English quite soon. What was it? I got reborn in another world as Yamcha.
Oh, that, yeah.
Gee, that's a better story than Broly.
I'll read it.
To be fair to Brawley in the movies, he did get mooned by a couple of kids. He took a lot of crap for somebody who was like stupidly overpowered.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about it, though, is the original Brawley character from the movies wasn't done by Akira Toriyama. It was drawn by him, but in typical Akira Toriyama style, he just drew something and just gave it to someone else to play with. Which is how Dragon Ball GT came around. He's a guy that forgets he's done stuff. He's like, he's notorious for that.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I'm not really a fan of Dragon Ball. I stopped being a fan of it ages ago, so I really don't care about Brawley or whoever's coming back. I just
revelation.
No, all I'm going to say is there are several ways to define insanity, and one of them is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Dragon Ball is a good example of that.
Yeah. When I first heard this information, I was like, oh, Christ, he's just rehashing the entire concept of his the 90s character Brawley. Then I read the details in like an interview that Toriyama released afterwards, and says, so as you know, that your new Brawley character from the 90s, the movies that I apparently drew the art for, but I have no memory of, so you know, he admits what he's done.
And he's just saying that.
He's just done this for years.
Yeah. Anyway.
He's redoing the entire concept of the character, so like it's just Brawley in name only.
Yeah.
So anyway, the question is, Andrew, are you excited?
I was originally. Then I heard it was Brawley coming back. I was like, oh, Christ, no. But then I realised, when I read the details, and that Toriyama's going to give him a new backstory, a new concept. I'm curious, at least. I'm not as excited as I was, but I'm curious, and I'll probably go see it in the cinemas because it's getting a cinema release in the US, so we'll probably end up seeing it up here like it was a fair Resurrection F. But Resurrection F, you know, when they brought Freezer back, I thought I was let down as well.
Yeah, I don't blame you if you want to go to the cinema. I mean,
it's an experience.
Can I just interject here, right? Because really, I'll be honest, I want to kill this Dragon Ball discussion. I blame all of the fans who still can't see that Dragon Ball now is basically like Die Hard, okay? It's like it's gone down the Die Hard route. It is now like, you know that Die Hard that they had in Russia where you couldn't even see the blood and he wasn't allowed to swear? He couldn't even say his trademark yippee-ki-yay thing?
It has gotten to that stage.
And that's the thing. So if you're going to blame anybody for this, you know, blame the fans for still accepting this rubbish. It's rubbish.
It's basically a cash-in.
Yeah.
But again, at the same time, is it a cash-in when Toriyama was like made rich or Dr. Slump?
It's junk food, isn't it? It's junk food anime. And seriously, going off what we talked about a couple of episodes ago when we were talking about Jamie Oliver waging war on cartoon characters on junk food, right? Jamie Oliver needs to wage war on Dragon Ball. Dragon Ball is the junk food of anime. You need to stop people watching Dragon Ball, Jamie Oliver. You need to campaign against it. You need to do the right thing, Jamie Oliver. Do the right thing, goddammit. Otherwise, we will blame you.
Stop this Russian
group. There are always things going on, and it's a good... That's kind of brings one to the topic of... the dreaded T word. Trigger.
Trigger?
Trigger?
Trigger.
You all right, Dev?
Yeah. Oh, Trigger's got a Patreon.
Does he? Is this so you buy
him back?
Is he dead?
What you idiot? So fillings.
Isn't he dead? Isn't the guy who played Trigger dead?
Not that attitude, he's not.
Yeah, so I think he is, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, I think, actually, unfortunately.
Yeah, but he played Trigger magnificently, but yeah.
I don't think this news is anywhere near as magnificent as Trigger. The character, yeah. Trigger.
So what is it about Trigger and Patreon? Are we on about Trigger, or are we on about Trigger as in a gun, or are we on about Trigger as in Studio Trigger, who haven't saved
Studio
anime?
Trigger and the Patreon.
Studio Trigger have a Patreon.
If it's in America, they will have a gun that's crowdfunding right now.
Yeah. So hang on.
I'm going to see if I can find it.
Just back up a second. Studio Trigger have a Patreon?
Aye. They're like literally, they're just asking fans money enough for like merchandising.
Oh, wow.
That's all I've said. That's all I've said about it. So it's like, I haven't said if they're actually taking the money in, they're actually funding their actual studio stuff either.
I'm sorry.
So it's very big.
No, they've actually genuinely got one.
Can I just say something? Can I just say something? And I'm probably going to offend a lot of people with this, but this is basically the truth. Studio Trigger is a business designed to make profit, okay? It's not a volunteer organization. It's not a charity. It is an actual dyed-in-the-wool business. And if for them to have a Patreon, okay. If they had no other income, right? If they were like other creators, like artists, people like that, people that we know, yeah? Amateur comic book creators, independent artists, independent animators. If they were like them, then I'd say, fine, have a Patreon. It's great. I might even support them myself. But they're not. They're a business. They have to pay taxes and all sorts of other things, right? Aye. They have employees. They're a business. So for them to have a Patreon kind of defeats the purpose of Patreon, doesn't it?
Well, it does. This is what they've got on the thing. Studio Trigger is creating animation and illustration. So why Patreon? We're a studio that strives for a global audience and values communications with our fans. If you've been in a creative business, I bet we can all relate that a simple feedback is all it takes to make our day great. However, there's no denying at times we wished we had an extra book or two. There's been one too many incidents where we've had to give up a merchandise idea because it was unprofitable or simply due to lack of funding. That's where you and Patreon come in. With your support, we would like to forward funds into various aspects of the studio.
So basically,
a new line of merchandise, attending/conducting more events, or simply providing a little more to our staff.
So basically, they want you to fund their merchandise and then buy their merchandise.
Yeah.
Right.
No, this is the thing, because in there, this is, they usually have merchandise and ideas which are unprofitable. There's the word, unprofitable.
If it's unprofitable,
they want you to pay for merchandise that is guaranteed to make a loss.
Yeah. So here's the thing. If you haven't realized it yet, listeners, if you are sponsoring Studio Trigger with their Patreon, or if you're thinking about giving them some money through Patreon, then I would seriously suggest you get some professional help. And by professional, I don't mean anybody who deals with mental health. I mean an actual business person, right? Who can explain it to you why what Studio Trigger are doing is just plain wrong.
Well, you know what it is? I'm just going to have a look and see what Studio Trigger's got, just because I can't remember everything off the top of my head. Do you know what they could do? They could get some of the stuff out to buy.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
Let's face it, Kill the Kill. I mean, you had to buy that in three parts, didn't you? So that's been out for a while.
Yeah.
Space Patrol Lulaco, I would happily buy that. I can't buy that.
Yeah.
Little Witch Academia, I would happily buy that. I can't buy that.
Yeah, but Mark, my point is this, okay? What they're doing is the equivalent of, say, Barclays Bank in every single one of their branches having a charity pot and saying, our bankers are homeless and hungry. Please help.
Yeah,
it is. It's kind of like trying to donate to the Tory party. Our offshore accounts are offshore. Please, can you pay for our champagne?
Yeah, it's literally that. So what Studio Trigger are doing is just plain wrong. And frankly, they should know better. Studio Trigger haven't saved anime.
From what I'm gathering, if you back the Patreon, you get, for $1, you get a JPEG from the live drawn session. Which I'm assuming you get a watch as well.
A JPEG from the live drawing session. JPEG.
That's it.
A goddamn JPEG. Which you
got for the $5 or more, you get access to PSD.ei Clip Studio file with the layers untouched from the live drawn.
I really don't care. See, the thing is, those aren't incentives enough for me to actually fund them. They're basically going on the back of their popularity with things like Kill la Kill and Little Witch Academia, neither of which were particularly great, but they're going on the back of the popularity of those, and they're trying to get people to give them money for stuff that they'll eventually charge people for. They're a business. This is a very underhanded and sneaky way of doing things, and they should literally be ashamed of themselves.
I agree.
It's absolutely
appalling that they've went down this route, and the problem I have is, I was contacted because SonicCon, at SonicCon, we do a lot of charity things.
Yeah.
We were recently contacted by a charity in Japan. And what the charity does is it actually feeds and houses struggling animators, because obviously it's an absolute shark nest in the animation industry in Japan. And what happens is a lot of these people actually starve themselves. And, like, you know, they'll go homeless just to try and pursue that dream.
Yeah.
And that's dedicated independent artists and animators who just want a foothold in this industry, and they're willing to go to extreme lengths to get it. And this charity, what they do is they'll give them, they'll pay for the rent at an apartment, they'll pay for their food subsidies and whatnot. And it's like, it's really like bare bones of your ass stuff. And they're getting like a basic of incomes. All they want to do is follow their passion.
Yeah.
And these are the artists that we should be supporting. This is what Patreon was made for. We have very little equipment. All money's off our own backs and whatnot. You know, we're not multimillionaires. Don't get contracted by big animation firms or companies saying, look, here, we want this and we'll give you extra for merchandising and that. And these guys, you know, they get paid the wage. And for them to turn around and say, oh, our fans, our loyal, generous fans, give us some more money and we'll do amazing things. We'll make merchandise that was seen as non-profitable before, but with yous, we can make it profitable. That's like if I turn around the attendees at SonicCon and say, look, we're looking to do merchandise. You give us the money, you fund it, and then we'll give you the opportunity to buy it.
Yeah.
Well, I'd have people after us.
If Studio Trigger did the Patreon and said, actually, no, I'm not even going to say that because that they might change the text on their Patreon and then they'll sucker people into it. So I'm going to keep that idea to myself. All you should know is I'm absolutely disgusted by them. With all sincerity, to Studio Trigger, fuck you.
Oh,
I was expecting that.
Quite a lot as well. They've got like $8,000. They're getting like $8,000 a month.
No, fuck seriously.
Off. What?
No, seriously. Seriously.
Really?
Seriously. Go and fuck yourselves.
Studio, I'm sure there's like over 2,500 people or something.
I blame them for the eventual downfall of anime in the Western world.
Did any of us watch that Darling in the Franxx?
I started it to give up about 5 episodes in because I just was doing
nothing. I stubbornly finished it.
I heard it got really, really bad in the second half.
It did. Very bad, actually.
Like I said, I blame Studio Trigger for a lot of things. But anyway, I am going to talk about blame now because I want to get it out of the way.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. So, anyway. Hey! Blame by Tsutomu Nihei. It's the movie based on the manga, which is actually pronounced Blam because it's supposed to be the sound a gun makes. In this case, the gravitational beam emitter that's the main character, Killy or Kiri, however you want to pronounce his name, wanders around with. It's a proper dyed-in-the-wool, hardcore science fiction manga, which is right up my street. The basic plot is that it's in the far future, and it's ostensibly Earth, kind of, and there is this thing called the City. Now, it's never fully explained in the movie, anyway, whether the City is covering the Earth, but basically the city is constantly expanding, it's constantly being built by these robots. Humans have been pushed into these little enclaves where they're basically fighting for survival, for food, for all sorts of things like that, and they're up against the robots. Think the Matrix, but only more extreme, and with less of the tribal raving that was in the second movie. So basically the city is this massive entity that's run by a core artificial intelligence program. Now, Killy is going around looking for humans that have net terminal genes because these humans will be able to access the main AI of the city and be able to tell it to stop what it's doing. They'll be able to give it orders. And he's been looking for humans who have the net terminal gene for a long, long time. It's never clear how long. In the movie, you start off with a group of youths who basically come from a village somewhere in one of the levels of the city. And they're basically out to look for this sludge which serves as a food substance for them. And they're basically snuck out of the village. Along the way, they're basically taking care. They're doing all the things that they should be doing. But they're kids. They're not experienced being out in this technological wilderness, because that's what it is. It's basically a dystopian future. The city is grim, it's dark, it's very, very, very cyberpunk.
It's not even a city really, though, is it? It just looks like corridors and like just areas like with nothing in it, really, doesn't it?
That's what I mean. The whole point of the Koi AI, it keeps building, and it keeps building the city, and where they are is basically a place where it's ostensibly been abandoned by the main AI program, by the thing that runs the city. The city is basically, it just keeps being built and built and built, and it's basically like a technological cancer on whatever planet forms the core of the city, right? So, in that scenario, you've got these kids looking for some kind of food for their village, and then they accidentally set off the alarm on one of the watchtowers, and they're attacked by these things called Safeguard. Now, the Safeguard are basically cyborgs. They're basically robots. And they are tasked with one thing, because humans by now are classed as intruders to the city because they don't have the net terminal gene. And because they're classed as intruders, the Safeguard will kill them on sight. It will eliminate all humans who don't have the net terminal gene. And so these kids are attacked by these Safeguard, and that's when the leader of this little group, I think, if I remember rightly, her name is Suzu, she runs into Killy, who fires his gravitational beam emitter, and there's a massive red line across the cityscape on that level, a massive explosion, and there's holes through basically everything, and Suzu's going, what the f*** just happened? Because Killy is basically, he's standing there, and he looks, to all intents and purposes, he looks human. And he identifies himself as human. But he's not wearing any of the protective gear that humans would normally wear. So, yeah, that's where the story starts off. Now, I'm not going to say anything else about what happens in the rest of it. Satomu Nihei, if you've never heard of him, he is the guy who was also the brains behind Knights of Cydonia, which was also done by Netflix. And this was on Netflix as well. The thing about Blame the Movie, it's CG, but it's cel-shaded CG, and it was directed by Hiroyuki Seshita, who has done various other things as well. It's, how do I explain? It's got some great visuals to it. It's slightly different from the way the manga is, and on the Blu-ray for this, and watch this in Blu-ray, by the way, because it is amazing in Blu-ray. On the Blu-ray for this, there is also a making of, which is very well worth watching, because they talk about how Satomu Nihei was very much involved in the production of the movie. And so what he tasked the director and the producers and the animators with is making the city, but updating it so that it would appeal to a modern audience, because you've read part of the manga for Blame, Mark.
Yeah, I've read the first volume of it.
You know what I'm talking about when I say this. If they followed the core design of the manga for the city, it wouldn't be as appealing to a modern audience.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the style for the manga as well, it's very off-putting.
Yeah.
Like, I got into it after watching this movie, and I feel like if it was the other way around, I probably would have given up on it quite quickly.
Yeah.
But I knew that there was more to come with it, so I did stick with it, and it was very rewarding, even if I've just read the first volume.
Yeah, which is the opposite of me. I started reading the manga first a long time ago because I am literally a sci-fi junkie. And if it's science fiction, all you have to do is say, Rob, it's science fiction, and I will stop and go, what is? And then you tell me what's science fiction. And if it's worth my time, I'll watch it, or read it, or play it. And if it's not worth my time, I'll probably punch you. Because you don't mess with the sci-fi junkie. So, yeah, Blame, however you want to pronounce it, because it's spelt Blame, but it's pronounced Blam. So,
Blame.
We just call it Blame because it's easier. Netflix have basically got an amazing thing on their hands, and the reason why I say that is because the manga doesn't do it, the movie doesn't do it, the animated shorts from the early 2000s don't do it, but Netflix could. This is the kind of environment where there are so many stories you could tell, because what you have is literally a man with no name scenario. Killy is basically a wanderer through different levels. He says it very early on in this movie. He's come from 6,000 levels below. There are so many adventures. It's basically like a dystopian sci-fi One Piece. There are so many things that they could do with Blame. It's actually quite scary. And
yeah.
What I would love to see Netflix doing, and I'd love to see Tsutomu Nihei and Netflix and the rest of the gang who've made this film, I'd love to see them start telling more stories in the world of Blame, because it is a fascinating world. It's a fascinating idea of just an artificial city-building intelligence or city-controlling intelligence going out of control and constantly building the city.
There is a spin-off, though, isn't there?
Oh, Blame Academy.
Yeah. I'm assuming, is that something a little bit different?
It's very different. Think, they did a spin-off of Attack on Titan called Attack on Titan High School or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, think that.
Ah.
Yeah, it's not very good.
They're not in the same world.
Yeah. Now, a couple of things I want to point out with the dub. This is eminently watchable in either the English or the Japanese dub, and they are both very, very on point. They're both excellent dubs. Cal McCarley plays the role of Killy in the English dub, and Christina V plays the character of Professor Sebo. Christine Marie Cabanos plays Zuru, and Keith Silverstein plays Sutezo. It's a very good cast they've got in this. Kira Buckland, Karen Strassman, Cassandra Morris, Brian Beacock, Johnny Young Bosch, Bryce Pattenbrook. Sheremy's in this as well. Ah, damn, I should have asked her about this. It's a very good movie. It's not a brilliant movie, but it's a very good movie. And if you're a sci-fi junkie like me, this is basically a door to a dystopian world that you will really want to explore.
And if you're unsure, it's on Netflix, so you can...
You can watch it. And as with you, Mark, I'm glad it's on Netflix, because I would probably buy this because I am a sci-fi junkie, right? And it's sci-fi, so it would look great on my shelf. But I don't know if anyone else would buy it unless they're a massive Tsutomu Nihei fan. Or if you own Knights of Cydonia already. Because if you own Knights of Cydonia, then you're probably going to get Blame.
Yeah, I'd agree.
So, we've got time for one more thing.
Yes.
Yes.
It's a tale that we all know.
Yes. In the land where I was born, there lived a man who sailed the sea.
Captain Birdseye.
No.
Is it Luffy?
No.
Is it Monkey D. Luffy?
No. This man lived beneath the waves.
It's not Tucky, is it?
Tucky doesn't live beneath the waves.
I was a sea monster for 2 years only.
Tucky no longer lives the waves. He now ploughs the ocean waves. He flogs the Oggin.
In his yellow submarine.
Yes. Yeah. It's 50 years since Yellow Submarine first came out, and they've basically been celebrating with a new cinema release for the restored, updated Yellow Submarine. And we managed to watch the restored, updated version of Yellow Submarine because we got a press screener for it. So what did you guys think?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, like I said, I think in the chat before we really started, I haven't watched this since music class. So I was probably about 10, maybe 12 or so when I first watched it, and I didn't really appreciate it back then. But being able to go back and watch it, I really did enjoy it a whole lot more. And yeah, it was just one of those films that was so good. It's like, normally if I'm watching a film and I want to do something else, I will stop the film and just do something else. But this was like, yeah, it's getting late. I'm not going to stop watching it, though. I really enjoyed it.
I didn't pay that much attention when I was watching it, unfortunately, but like the last time I saw this was about 18, 20 years ago when I was in primary school.
I thought you were going to say 1828. I was going to say, how old are you, Andrew?
Got lost in the sea of time.
Yeah, you got lost in the sea of time. No, there's the sea of time in this, isn't there? Where they go forwards and backwards in time. He got lost in the sea of time, ended up in 1828 in Austria, where he became a composer.
The thing I love about the film is that it's essentially just a way for people to go and listen to the Beatles music, but the narrative in between is actually stupidly fun. You can tell they were just like,
yeah,
what are we going to do with this? It's like, well, we'll just do that. Will it work in the story? Doesn't matter. We'll make it.
Do you know what I love about this is it has various types of animation and art on display, which I think is a brilliant thing, because this was directed by George Dunning, produced by United Artists and King Features. George Dunning was, you know, he did various things, but he spent a lot of time working as an animator. And I think this is the only thing that he actually directed. So,
and he worked on the Monty Python animations as well, which is
why he worked on the Monty Python
nice
animations,
style.
Which, yeah, because you get the Monty Python vibe from a lot of it.
Yeah.
It's more Monty Python on acid with the Beatles playing in the background.
Yeah.
That's essentially what it is.
What do you think then, Tucky?
Oh, it's absolute trip. It's like dad jokes mixed in with weird animation. I mean, the storyline, right? You start off in Pepperland with Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, which is obviously like, you know, the album and whatnot.
Yeah.
And that never made sense to me. The whole, like, you know, I know of the Beatles, obviously. You know, I'm quite connected. I'd like to think I'm quite connected with Liverpool as a city, and I know all the, like, touristy things and whatnot. And the Beatles, for me, it was just like the music. John Lennon, Yoko Ono ruined them. Paul McCartney still, like, pops his head out every New Year to have a good time. And Ringo Starr being Thomas the Tank, of course. But it's like having all that, like, into this one animation. And the thing was, it's like the Pepperland attack from the Blue Meanies. They say, "We are Blue Meanies, we never say yes." The top dramatic. Some kind of like, you know on Willy Wonka where she eats that fruit and turns blue?
Oh, yeah.
Like the it's like, oh, it's now blueberry pine. She becomes a blueberry. It's kind of like that lass. as in like full Rocky Horror tranny like garb.
No, you mean
attacking a load of middle class English folk who just get a nice day out with some cricket and
so basically what you're trying
the
to
music.
Yeah. So what you're trying to say there, Tucky, is the leader of the Blue Meanies is a cross between Violet Beauregard and Frankenfurter.
Yeah.
I'm just condensing everything Tucky said there to a few words.
It's
a very strange time.
Yeah,
it's absolutely fantastic. I mean that one line where Ringo starts and he's like, "Oh, it's always a lonely night on Saturday in Liverpool. One can get quite lonely, and it's only Tuesday."
Oh no, there's a better line right after that. Because he says, "Oh, I'm tempted to jump in the Mersey, but it's raining."
It's absolute daftness. I think the police officer's on the floor. Yeah, posse, posse, posse. Yeah, posse, posse. And he just walks by and says, like, "Would you believe I'm being chased by a yellow submarine?" And the policeman's like, "No." He's like, "Oh, I thought you wouldn't." And he just runs into the house.
Which is a house then full of doors. It's a house full of doors.
What's the bloke's? The house in Liverpool?
Yeah, the house in Liverpool is a house full of doors. What I love, though, is, yeah, you know the captain of the Yellow Submarine who's been forced to captain the Yellow Submarine? I love the way
Tom.
Yeah, Old Tom. I love the way he explains what's happening. He's like, "The submarine, explosion, Blue Meanies."
Just trying to get them. That part where it's like, "Oh, it's Frankenstein. Don't pull that lever." "Oh, but I'm a natural-born lever puller." Like Liverpool, and I'm like that's the ultimate dad joke in this. It can't get better, and it does. It gets so much better because Frankenstein sits up as a drink, and it turns out to be it's John Lennon. Told you not to go to sleep without eating something.
Just a quick thing. I'm going to disappoint you here, Tucky.
Oh,
yeah, I'm going to disappoint
me.
All of you. The characters in this, the animated characters, the Beatles, and not actually in this until the very end, and obviously in the song.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I suppose sabotaged.
But the thing is, the guys that they chose to play the Beatles sound a lot like the Beatles.
It's one of the easiest accents.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If I can do it, anyone can.
Obviously, it's the 60s, you know, and so there's all sorts going around, and the music was really well, was really interesting, I thought, because they had songs like Eleanor Rigby and All Together Now, and obviously they had Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band as one of the songs, and Yellow Submarine. I think one of my favourites, though, was when they meet Jeremy Hillboob, PhD, and they start singing Nowhere Man.
Aye.
Oh, yeah. It was a very fun scene. Yeah. Sorry, it was a very fun film. It was
One of the things that I found interesting was right at the beginning, after old Tom gets in the Yellow Submarine, you basically have this scene where Eleanor Rigby's playing, and what you have is kind of proto-GIFs on screen. The way they've animated things is basically that repeated animation sequence, which is a GIF now.
Yeah.
And they had those on display there with, like, the dog running up to the guy and the guy bending over to pet it, and then you've got the football teams and everything like that.
I'm just remembering, like, the Reds versus the Blues. It's Liverpool-Everton.
Yeah.
And actually, like, they had some of the actual landmarks of Liverpool.
Yeah.
And actually, that one thing where it's, like, near the beginning where they zoomed and it just went through all of Great Britain, little still shots of, like, famous areas. And how weird Britain used to look back in the 60s.
Yeah. It's a fascinating film because when they reach the Sea of Time, for example, and they start bringing out these concepts, I think we slipped into Einstein's space-time continuum, but it's all relative.
it's great little jokes like that.
Yeah.
And the whole, that part at the end where he's like, oh, are you us? No, I'm just, apparently you're just an image of myself manifested. Just like little simple, like, out there theories, which, you know, hippies used to always go on about. But it's actually like grounded in science.
Yeah, but that was one of the beautiful things about it, was that most people these days probably don't get what that was on about. They're just like, I don't quite understand why they're talking like that, why they're saying this stuff. It has no bearing on the story. And like, screw the story. This is the type of movie that you watched when you'd had a few. And I'm not talking alcohol. And there is there is a song in this movie which says it all. And that song is obviously Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Everyone knows that song's about
LSD. It's a proper hippie movie. I mean, the thing is, like, watching it, because I'd never watched it before.
Yeah.
Surprisingly. And like I say, I didn't get the whole shtick with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club and that. And watching this now, I do get it. And that thing at the end where they actually have the Beatles is like, it's proper like cheesy 60s cinema thing. Like, oh, all the people in the theatre, I can see. Look, we've brought the engine from the submarine.
Yeah.
Oh, and I've still got a hole in my pocket.
Yep.
just Ringo like that. They just ripped the crap out of him.
Oh, yeah. I love the fact that Ringo is perpetually the fall guy, isn't he?
Yeah.
He is. He's just poor bugger. No wonder he turned out like he did.
Do you know the other thing I thought was hilarious, though, was the fact that they had John as Frankenstein in the house. Ringo was obviously the guy that old Tom went to. And you got George, who's basically in India, pretending to be a yogi or something like that, which I thought was hilarious because that was right on the nose. Then you had, they open the door and they go, oh, look at that. All you can hear in the door is women screaming and going, ah, you know. Or if it was Japan, they'd be going, kya. And then Paul suddenly walks out fixing his cravat. It's like,
we're a bouquet of flowers.
Yeah, it's so on the nose with the depictions of him because Paul was the ladies' man, wasn't he?
Yeah, that was the thing with Georgia. It's like, oh, look, it's sitar, dear.
Yeah, he was the sitar hero.
Yeah, it's, hey, that's my car. What colour is it? He's just driving back and forward in different. It's all yellow. It's red. It's green.
It's all in the mind. Do you think George Harrison ever played air sitar? See, that's a dad joke that should have been in there.
That groundbreaking, he would have been. He would have done it.
But yeah, Yellow Submarine.
Wacky Beatles.
Yellow Submarine, yep. I kind of adore it. Do you know what it reminded me of in a lot of ways? Or rather, I've got to flip it round because it's the opposite, because Masaaki Yuasa is current and the Beatles were in the 60s. I've got to say that after watching Yellow Submarine, Night is Short, Walk On Girl, Lou Over the Wall, Kaiba. In fact, most of Masaaki Yuasa's work reminds me of Yellow Submarine.
Yeah, well, to be honest, when I was watching that, I was getting very violent flashbacks to Belladonna of Sadness as well.
Yeah, I suppose. Especially
how random it was.
Well, especially during that Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds video, I can see that as well.
Yeah. But yeah, it was...
It's good to show that the 60s were like, you know, they were a lot more further ahead in time, a lot more pioneering and innovative in the 60s. Now, a lot of times people give them credit for, people think like the 60s were so far back, they were so far behind, they were so primitive. Nah, man, they were doing stuff like Yellow Submarine.
Okay, so just to round this off then, what would you guys recommend to watch alongside Yellow Submarine?
Watch? I don't know, but like, I do sometimes listen like a psychedelic music from the 60s and 70s anyways, so like, Pink Floyd. That's all I can recommend. I don't know what to watch.
I wouldn't want to say like watch like alongside it, but I don't know if it was something Ivor the Engine.
That's
children's cartoons, like Ivor the Engine, like with Bagpuss and whatnot, that kind of thing, because it all like links in. That's the feel I get from it.
Okay.
I was going to say something like a little bit more normal to kind of bring you down and ground you a little bit, but I'm just going to say Mind Game.
You would,
because that could be lethal, to be honest.
Yeah. The obvious answers are what I said, Masaaki Yuasa's Night is Short, Walk On Girl, or Lou Over the Wall, or something like that, or even Monty Python. You know, those are the obvious answers. But if I was going to say anything, do you know what I'd say? I'd say, what's Opera Doc? You know that one from Warner Brothers, the Looney Tunes one?
Bugs Bunny.
Bugs Bunny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Ford.
You know the one where they're basically doing opera, but they're doing it in the Looney Tunes way? So they got the Barbara Seville, they're doing Wagner and all sorts of other opera, and it's basically, at the end of it, you've got Elmer Fudd walking away with the body of Bugs Bunny going, poor little bunny. So, yeah, I think that would make an interesting combination. Because I think that was around the same time as Yellow Submarine.
I think it was.
It would have been. That was like Sorcerer's Apprentice kind of thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because the Sorcerer's Apprentice from Disney with the Mickey Mouse and all the... Fantasia.
Yeah, 1957.
And Warner Brothers like came back with the Bugs Bunny Opera.
Yeah.
Both classics.
1957, What's Opera Doc? And that's the one where Elmer Fudd is, you know, he's doing Kill the Wabbit, Kill the Wabbit, Kill the Wabbit, Kill the Wabbit.
Classics. Absolute classics.
So I think...
a lot of flashbacks of my childhood as well, just watching all this stuff when it was like, yeah, and on the telly.
You understand why I've chosen What's Opera Doc, though, don't you?
Yeah. It's got that similar sort of just nutty vibe. It's got a little bit of psychedelic vibe as well, but it's got that sort of like...
The thing is, it's taking music that you're familiar with, and Beatles music is something that everyone's generally got some knowledge of. And What's Opera Doc is opera, so obviously everyone's heard of The Ride of the Valkyries and other things that are in What's Opera Doc. They just might not realise it's opera. And it's basically giving them a twist.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's a lot of fun. I mean, it's good to just, like, sit back and enjoy something different and wacky.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that's us, isn't it?
Yeah. That is us.
So, until next time, you can find all of our episodes, previous ones, that is, on our website or on Apple Podcasts or Audio Boom or the podcast provider of your choice. So if you are listening through anything like that, then give us a rating, because it does help us with visibility and various things like that.
A good one.
Yeah, if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on various social media, including Twitter, which is...
at Keyframe Podcast.
Or you can email us, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. That's it from us. We'll see you all next time on Keyframe. Until then, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
I've been Mark.
And I've been Tucky.
Away with yous.
Yes, away with you all. Be gone, peasants.
I'm going to go build a waifu.
And remember... and remember, don't give any money to Trigger.
Remember, that's very important.
Pie.
Pie. Pie.